Welcome to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast, the show dedicated to the private investor, and I'm your host, Jerry Alexander. We want to show you how to cross the divide from residential investing over to commercial property investing. Through interviews, tips, and lessons learned, we share experiences of investing and give you the inspiration, knowledge, and confidence to enjoy this great cash flowing strategy. So let's get started. Hello, welcome back to the podcast. Thanks for joining me. Today we've got a special guest, somebody who's been on the show before, Andrew McDonald. If you don't know Andrew, he has worn many interesting hats during his property career, which has led him to have a really good understanding of the market and all the different players in the market, and as a consequence has a very balanced approach. He's been appraising, investing and managing commercial property assets for a long time. It's actually been 18 months since we last had him on the podcast, which was back in May 21 on episode 66, and a lot has changed since then. So I thought we'd have him back to have a chat through a number of topics, some new and some relating to things that we spoke about back on that episode. So here's some of the things we've included. What's really happening with permitted development rights? Where is the retail sector right now? What about flex space? What's happening with yield rates? And of course, something that's coming up more and more, how many deals are actually falling out of bed right now? And then finally, what opportunities should private investors be looking at right now? I'm really grateful Andrew agreed to share some more of his time with us, and I'm sure you'll find this episode really informative. Let's dive in. Welcome back to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast. And today I have Andrew McDonald joining me again. It's been 18 months since we last spoke, Andrew. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back. I can't believe it's been so long. As we were just saying a few minutes ago, there's been so much has happened in between that time.
Yeah, I thought it was maybe about 6 months, but then I realised it was May 21 when we last spoke.
Yeah.
And maybe one or two things have changed out there in the market. That was back in episode 66, I think it was. And we spoke mainly about retail, but I think our discussion today is probably going to have to expand a little bit from that because, yeah, I mean, every week something seems to change, but 18 months is a long time.
Yes, especially in politics. I say a week's a long time in politics, don't they? But 18 months is a lifetime nowadays, I guess, by that logic.
It's crazy. Maybe the first thing for us to do is just refresh the memories of our listeners of what you do, Andrew. And maybe you could just introduce your business as well, just give you a chance to set the context.
Yeah, sure. thanks again. I've been a commercial property agent for 28 years now, 27 years. 25 of those were in the corporate sector. So I had a vanilla career up in the West End, working for, I think, three or four corporate agencies over that time. It was four, actually. So, yeah, I was dealing with. The first 10 years, I was leasing shops up and down the country and shopping centres. And then I moved after 10 years to work on the capital market side. So that was brokering high street and associated property investments for a range of clients, mainly institutions, but other property companies and high net worth individuals. So we're either selling property investments for these clients or we took a brief from them and were scouring the market to try and find their deals and ultimately broker them. That's what I did for the first 25 years. It was time for a break after a life sentence. After a good run at it, I wanted to change the scene.
So what's now? What's happening now?
Well, I left in 2020, my corporate job, and I had 2020 off, and then I set up my own commercial agency called Tandon Real Estate. And we still do the same thing, which is, you know, source deals for a range of clients. But part of the reason for leaving was also to get involved in a few more development projects on my own account. So we've set up the Credo Group, which is effectively a brand collaboration between architects, agents and building consultants. And we're out looking at buying for conversion property on our own account, but also providing what we call a one-stop shop asset management service to busy and ambitious landlords. So we're effectively a delivery partner for under-resourced and overstretched landlords to get the best out of their property. So that's been a push for the last 6 or 9 months, getting that sort of market tested and market ready. And we're having some some success there.
Great.
But also,
I was just going to say, and that's multi-sector, isn't it? That's not just retail now. You're across different sectors on those projects.
Yeah, I mean, our building consultants and architects work on a variety of sectors. On the agency side, our strength is in retail and, you know, leisure and associated subsectors. But we've got the ability to transcend sectors now, depending upon what the client wants. So it's portfolio landlords really who don't have the time to get the best out of their assets, and you know that's a problem with vacancy rates at the moment.
Okay, that's interesting, because the big chunk of time there was really maybe working more with institutional investors. Would that be fair to say?
Well, initially it was, yeah. Throughout my corporate career,
yeah.
It has been working with the institutional investors.
But now it's more private investors as well, as some institutional investors.
Yeah. Institutional investors tend to have their own asset management teams, so yeah. You know, arguably we tread on their toes. But it's property companies with, you know, 20, 50, 100 assets. So it's that sort of tier down, or a few tiers down from institutional investors that we're working with at the moment.
And do you find, just out of interest, do you find that most of the chat conversation in the market is generally led with the context of institutional investing? You know, so for instance, if you pick up the Sunday papers and it starts talking about commercial retail sector, do you find they tend to be talking more to the institutional investors rather than the private?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Certainly in the commercial sectors.
Yeah.
The residential sector has been dominated and is to an extent still by the private investor. Although, of course, the rise of the BTR market is bringing the institutions on board. But the majority of our high streets and our shopping centres, our retail warehouses, our big town centre offices, our industrial estates, these are primarily owned and operated, or owned and managed by the institutions. That does drive the narrative.
Yeah. So as private investors, we maybe need to just be aware of that when we're listening to the chat.
Yes,
it might not affect us necessarily.
Not so bad, no. Don't read all you see in the press.
Okay, right. Let's. I've got a few questions around retail, of course. A little bit about where maybe yields are right now. Just a few different questions, just to update. But let's just talk about permitted development rights, if we can. So about 2020, summer 2020, things started to change. And this is predominantly for England, of course. In Scotland, there's a slightly different set of regulations. But the permitted development rights came out with a bang, or at least certainly within property sectors, there were certainly a lot of chat about them and how this was going to revolutionise the market and opportunity. Now we're a good bit of time into that. How are you seeing that unfold?
Yes, that was right. Because I think you and I were probably on sort of similar audience and panels on Clubhouse, weren't we? The new sort of prior approval permitted development rules were being, you know, heavily touted as the way forward at that stage. It's all wrapped up, as I see it, in just the sort of general turgid and malfunctioning or dysfunctioning planning system, really. We haven't seen the sort of level of conversions come through as had been expected. I wouldn't necessarily say that's because the permitted development rights don't work as had been anticipated, but obviously the whole system is grinding to a halt, or has grinded to some sort of halt. The permitted development, as some people like to call it, is more planning light. You know, there's more properties which sit in the crosshairs of permitted development, but the level of approvals which need to be gained or sought to actually get that consent are more prohibitive. And of course, you know, if you give the council or local authorities any decision to make, I'm talking in general here, but seems to grind things to a halt. I'm hopeful there'll be more deals to come, but it will largely, to my mind, depend upon the planning authorities moving at a greater pace.
Yeah, I think even in Scotland, it's a slightly different thing, but even in Scotland, you do notice which councils are forward-thinking and want to embrace that sort of thing, and then there's others that don't. So naturally, there's going to be some areas that's going to work better than others. But as you say, there are still some involvements with the councils and planning departments, and that's where it can get snarled up. But equally, I think there's some planning departments and councils who are trying to find ways of working their way around permitted development because they don't like from on high being told what to do.
Well, that's right. Yes, that is right. I mean, it does, or it could fundamentally alter the landscape or the look of a town centre over a period of time. The initial change to the planning rules was the ability to obviously let ground floor retail units to a variety of other uses. So rather than just being able to let prime shops to retailers, you could start letting prime shops to restaurants and such like. So that you know, taken to a natural conclusion, that can really change the makeup and the layup of a town.
Yeah.
And then you throw in the ability to turn upper parts into flats undertaken by developers who perhaps aren't, you know, qualified for it or with no real regard to design. Then, you know, over a period of time, and not much happens in property particularly quickly at all, of course, but over a period of time, you can see how the local authorities will worry about the nature of their town centres.
Yeah. Interesting, though, the state of some of their town centres right now.
Let me take a moment to thank Office R&D for supporting the podcast. It's really important to us that we only work with sponsors that we've used ourselves. It's all about being authentic, right? Office R&D is the best flexible workspace platform we've come across, and believe me, we've tried a few systems over the last 20 years. Office R&D helps us manage our invoicing, customer community, reporting, building access, and many more aspects of our day-to-day operations. Why not book yourself a free demo to see how they can help you free up more time to grow your business? Follow the partner link in the show notes.
Yeah.
It's maybe not quite what they had in mind either. So, let's be fair, something has to change, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah. No, there's a lot to be said for a lot of town centres.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about retail then. What trends are you seeing in that space? If I recollect back when we were talking, it was not the most popular form of investing at the time.
Yes.
And raising finance on it would have been quite difficult. Have you seen that change at all?
Well, I would say things were starting to turn around. And had been, you know, if I look at the major agencies in the West End, there were redundancies immediately post post the COVID lockdowns, and I noticed that the recruitment uptake or uptick was improving at the early part of this year, so people were being brought on board. I suppose a large part of that was because there were seats to fill after the COVID pandemic.
Sure, yeah.
But I'm hearing that's not the case anymore. There are sort of some redundancies coming through in the retail teams. But a large part of it was born out of the mini budget in September 2022. Yep. That's had an impact. So I'm not quite sure that's really filtered through yet. It's a brave man to really bet on where interest rates are going to be. But I mean, certainly they've moved up, and that's having an effect on people's borrowing rates. And of course, that's making yields on property, retail property, soften to get that arbitrage.
Absolutely. So the yields on retail, when we were discussing last time, had pushed out.
Yeah.
Did they continue? Did they harden? I mean, I appreciate in the last few months, maybe things have changed again, but over the earlier part of 2022, had those yield rates stabilized?
They'd certainly stabilized. Yeah. And of course, you look at prime, secondary, and tertiary. The tertiary market is and has been struggling ever since. So maybe I'd sort of narrow it down to the prime good secondary, which is stabilised. But yeah, they started to move out again. But that, you know, of course, they're looking very cheap in historic terms and context. So, you know, arguably, if you buy the right stock, it's a good time to be getting in.
Yeah. And as you say, with interest rates, if interest rates have gone up by 2% and the target return for someone is 6%, well, now they're going to be looking for, you know, plus two on top of whatever they were looking for before. It's just the basic numbers, isn't it?
That's right.
And have the yield rates in industrial softened? Do you get involved much in the industrial sector now?
Only through hearsay. My agency network up in the West End still talks about industrial. I'm still on the periphery of it, and the market, I think somebody was saying within the last 3 or 4 months had softened by, you know, it was a noticeable figure, whether it was 25%, I can't quite recall, but there had been a real softening of prime industrial yields, and that was, of course, going to throw.
So going from 4% to 5%, say.
Well, in prime Greater London, sub 3%.
Yeah, mad.
Yeah, absolutely madness. But that was driven by tenant demand, which I believe is still there. But you know, again, it's largely dependent upon interest rates.
Yeah. Okay. And in office sector, any? Difficult, isn't it? You know, are we talking about huge offices, small offices? You know, there's nuances there, but in general,
yeah. Again, offices. There's a cloud. I mean, I'd like to try and talk in more positive tones, and of course, at the, you know, with every cloud there is a silver lining. But just looking at the sort of property fundamentals, there is less investor appetite for offices as offices.
Yeah.
It's, you know, no one really knows what the future of offices are. You know, there will be a space for it, but in what capacity? It's still quite early on in the evolution post COVID, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Certainly when you're looking at the city centres, some of them are still struggling with the large floor plates. But in my sector, flex space, we've seen in general, certainly where we are, and the people I've spoken to in industry, a real strengthening of demand. Do you ever really get involved in flex space at all, Andrew?
Well, I do, yeah. I do have a client at the moment who's looking for flex space offices in and around where I live down in Surrey. Mm-hmm. I've done a sweep of the local market and local agents.
Yeah. What did you discover?
Well, a bit more interest than I had anticipated. Uh-huh. You know, obviously a landlord puts their office on the market expecting a 5-year or a 10-year term to hopefully a blue chip, and then after a number of months appreciates that might not well be possible. So you know, from a landlord's point of view, it's driven by, you know, pragmatism and realism. There's quite a few new entrants into the flex space, and you know, some will do a good job, and you know, many won't. But you know, if you can pin your hopes on a good operator, you should get a good rental return.
Yeah, of course, as a landlord, some will double up as the operator as well. What did you discover when you were looking at market demand in terms of actual tenants or clients for those spaces?
Well, the one operator I'm looking for at the moment, we haven't got one over the line yet. Mm-hmm. So we're engaging with a few landlords and a few agents. The occupier will want the landlord to bring the property up to a state of repair. So again, that's the level of capex which a lot of landlords don't necessarily want to play with at the moment. So that is a bit of a sticking point. But no, I've been encouraged by certainly not having the phone put down on me.
So this is essentially for, and we can't get into too much detail on your customer, but basically this is for somebody maybe doing, is it a management agreement or a rent to rent, rather than buying the property for themselves and then operating.
It's a management agreement, so they will come and use their systems, put one of their brands on and operate it on behalf of the landlord. So it's not a rent to rent model in the sense that you and I know. They take a management fee for you know, operating it in a good way for the landlord. But yes, it's on an occupational basis rather than the freehold purchase basis.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Something I've been hearing quite a bit about is the percentage of deals that they've been working on that are falling out of bed.
Yes.
Maybe slightly more in residential, but I think that's starting to come over to commercial too, where the appetite and the change of lending has meant that people that are maybe going in with a certain set of criteria that they're using actually aren't working right now. Have you seen an uptick in the number of deals coming back out to the market?
Yes. I mean, anecdotally, you speak to various disgruntled agents who had deals fall out of bed post the mini budget,
yeah,
for obvious reasons. You know, as a buyer, you're basing your returns on the, you know, on the horizon you can see, and you know, when that horizon changes through, you know, economic clouds, then you have to sort of think about what price you want to pay.
Yeah,
you know, property's a long game, isn't it? So in my view, it's better to drop a deal and escape rather than stick
and escape.
Yeah. You know, we want to be here alive and well at 65, still trading and operating without taking any risks.
So, yeah, anecdotally, yeah, you've seen the number of deals kind of increasing that are coming back to market.
Yes.
Have you seen landlord or at least vendor positions softening, or are they still holding out?
No, I've seen some softening. I have seen, I'm on various circulation lists from agents, from West End agents, and you know, I do actually get emails you know, blind copied in saying, you know, this is aborted, landlord's a bit more motivated to sell, and you know, they'll note the revised price on the mail
yes.
Yeah, so now I'm seeing that, and that is quite rare for it to be openly presented in such a way.
And I was speaking to a friend of mine yesterday who's looking at doing more residential buy to let, and he was saying that agents have been coming back to him recently saying, right, this has gone to fixed amount now, so this drop's gone to fix, it's not offers over. It's just whether we are at a point of inflection, or are we just going to have a nice little coaster? This is me asking you to get your crystal ball out now, Andrew, right?
So,
there's a lot of economic and international and political things going on that could direct things in any direction. However, having said that, in the last 18 months, there have been many things that have happened since we last spoke. And I just wonder whether people and investors are getting a little bit more of bad news fatigue. And in our own sector and our own customer base at the moment, things are still steady as she goes. That may change, of course. So on the ground for us, it's not reflecting the sentiments that you're hearing out there. What's your current feeling on where we're at and where we might be heading?
Well,
and of course, I mean, what the silver lining might be, indeed.
I think there are silver linings. I was fortunate enough in looking back at it to experience the credit crunch of 2007-2008.
Yep.
And that was a real seismic event. Coming at the end of 6, 7, 8 years of real, real strong growth, and you know, if you remember back at the news of those days, it's you know, it's hard to forget those pictures of bankers leaving their offices with their shoeboxes and you know, woe is me and news headlines, and for the right reasons, you know, it affected many people deeply. But there was a long period of stagnation and decline between 2008 and when it started to turn around, which I would say from my memory, we'd seen the bottom of the market by 2010, after the credit crunch, and then by 2011-12 it started to motor on again, and I kind of use that as a bellwether as to where we are now. I mean, the matters are different, and
slightly different. Yeah,
but the bald facts is, in both circumstances, where we are now and where we are there, you know, times were dire. And you know, if you look at other, there's so much money washing around the place.
Yeah.
And where do you put it? Property, you know, if retail is yielding prime at about 6%, secondary 8%, industrial maybe 5% or 4%, you know, that's still a good return. So with good stock selection, being well represented, knowing your tenants and knowing your towns, for the intelligent, sophisticated investor, I think there's going to be some real bargains out there.
Yeah. Especially from those that need to change and may not have a queue of buyers list out around the street where they maybe have had a few months ago or a year ago.
Yeah. I think, but what I would say is if you got it wrong, if an investor got it wrong now, then, you know, they could be in for a rough ride. So it's important to be even more educated, even more up to date, learn your patch, your niche, and really sort of narrow down into what you know.
Focus in both geographically and sector wise.
It's not, in my mind, it's not a chance, not the time to take a punt. unless you're brave.
So well, what opportunities do you think would you see coming up, and maybe more open this up to a wider, maybe sectorial or even geographical, but what sort of things do you think will be coming for those that are educating themselves? What sort of sectors do you see growing out of this or maintaining through this?
Well, I think what has been going well and what continues to go well is drive-through.
Mm-hmm.
Drive-through and roadside retail and roadside investments. Rents have gone up considerably. There's good occupational demand. I would still look at southeast and other affluent cities and suburbs retail warehousing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially those that you could sort of see an alternative use value for, be that residential or whatever else might come down the tracks. But just going back to what you said earlier, what I was noticing, I have seen quite a few vacant shops.
Mm-hmm.
Sale, freehold. That has definitely been more noticeable as far as I'm concerned, which tells me that there is pressure on certain landlords, you know, because ideally nobody wants to sell a vacant shop, because, you know, you'd rather get it income producing to a good tenant and sell it as an investment.
Sure.
So I think vacant shops, if you know, again, knowing your market, knowing where retailers want to be, perhaps cozying up to a few retailers, either direct or through their agents, working out where they want to be, finding vacant units for them, finding land for them, and, you know, marrying those deals up. You know, some vacant shops get put on the market through the same agent. They've been vacant for a year or two, maybe longer. Agent gets bored. It just needs to be in the right hands and a fresh marketing campaign. Yeah, I think there's going to be some bargains had from picking your seller correctly, those that might be more motivated to sell.
Yeah. For the smaller private investor, at the lower end of size in retail, what's your thoughts about that end of the market? I mean, my observation through some towns local to me would be that a lot of the small units, particularly those that are under, maybe just managed to get under the rateable threshold, have been well occupied since COVID, and have continued to be so. But those that are maybe more medium size to the larger, they're the ones that sit empty because they're just over the crux. They immediately have an extra expenditure going out before you get to maybe the larger ones where the occupant's prepared and used to spending those rates. It seems like that middle piece is getting pressed in some of those smaller locations. Would you agree with that? Or
yeah, I would. I think for those very small shops, the local independents, the home's to people's business. You know, it's not the case of leasing a middle-sized shop to a national multiple retailer. Yeah. Whereas if it's not quite doing as had been expected, you know, the retailer will renegotiate terms downwards, or they, you know, in certain circumstances they'll go through a CVA, or they'll leave at lease expiry. You know, the sort of the appetite to try and make it work amongst these national occupiers isn't quite as great as it is amongst the, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith or whoever yeah. it might be, who have to make it work to, you know, to run a business.
But the challenge, of course, to the investor is that is still seen as a weaker covenant, which is kind of a slight irony there, really.
Yeah,
one will manipulate things to maybe leave or change things, whereas the other one, their lifetime savings and everything's tied up in it.
It's quite right, you know. From a it's a box ticking exercise for a bank, isn't it?
Yeah.
In a way, and you know, how much time do their underwriters have to go into the granular level of detail to work out whether Mr. and Mrs. Smith and their baker is going to make it work? You know, they just don't have the time and capacity. But so, you know, when it comes to ticking a box, it's easier to look at companies' accounts or how many units they've got. You know, that's a sort of structural deficiency, really.
Yes, it is. Yeah. If I'm going to say any sort of prediction, would be I think those small units will continue being strong the shift to working from home has accelerated. I think there's people wanting to work near home, maybe not in home. Maybe some don't have the option, of course, of working at home. But it has benefited more local retail sector, smaller units. That's my observation.
Yeah. No, it's the same down here. Our local high street's looking a bit better. Although that said, the car park, much to my annoyance, to the local train station is busier. So I don't have the luxury of the park as I used to. But I've definitely noticed that over the last 3 or 6 months, the train stations to central London are busier. But the small local operators are definitely benefiting from the sort of work from home or work near home phenomenon which is going on, and that's great. That's great for our town centres.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so last sector, just to quickly touch on the energy crisis. So at the moment. Certainly in the domestic sector, most people are now probably off their tariffs, getting to that stage where it's starting to affect them. But commercial tariffs, some of them are in for 2 years, some of them longer, some of them shorter. But as those tick over, a bit like interest rates, when you get to the end of the fixed rate, it can be a nasty shock.
Yeah.
And there's some heavy energy users out there, whether it be hot food, maybe some leisure, industrial manufacturing. These sectors are going to potentially have a big challenge on the horizon.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts? Is there much conversation going on about that amongst your colleagues?
It's not leading the conversation. I think people are looking at it in a slightly different way, in that the cost of living crisis is obviously having, you know, the more noticeable part is the effect it will have on the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, how much can the consumer, this is, you know, most notably the retail sector, how much can the consumer spend on a monthly basis? And that's obviously going to have an impact on what the retailer can afford to pay for a unit. And then, of course, the retailer is getting squeezed on the other side by the rise in energy bills. It's a sort of a two-pronged attack, isn't it, on the occupier? That is to be noted. I mean, I sit at my local leisure centre when I occasionally get a bit of time, and they've got, you know, there's a sauna there and a you know, a whirlpool and all this. And I'm thinking, how the hell are they going to make that stack up when costs really start to bite?
it's going to be interesting how that works out. Yeah, I mean, obviously that might mean your pool will be a couple of degrees cooler than you're used to. but there will be some sectors that are going to really struggle unless they can find some ways of mitigating that. But it's going to be tough if their bills go from whatever level they are right now and maybe quadruple for some of them.
Yeah.
Unless there's intervention, of course. But I think, as you say about silver linings, you look at that and you think, well, there's probably trouble ahead for certain sectors and certain energy consuming businesses, and they are likely to be the ones that might start showing distress sooner than others. That's my basic point.
Yeah. Well, somebody's got to pay for it all, haven't they? So someone's got to be on the receiving end of these increasing costs and decrease in revenues. And, you know, the occupiers won't want to be that person. So they'll obviously be looking to reduce their costs, and that'll be, in certain circumstances, discussions with landlords.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to work with us to ensure that we can continue to trade from your outlet.
Yeah.
Of course, landlords are beholden in many instances on what they owe the bank, and so they can't necessarily be the charity which the occupier wants. So,
yeah,
sticky old position, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it is. So just looking forward again for a second, what areas do you think, or if you were talking to some private investors right now, would you be saying keep your powder dry, keep searching, and so when you see a deal, you know it's a good one? What would you be advising people right now?
So I'll tell you what. From my context, I think next year's we're probably going to see the after effects of the news, if that's the right way of saying it. We're going to see the fallout from the news. But what I'm doing is storing estate agents' details. So properties, mainly freehold properties, which have hit the market now for sale. If I like the look of them, I put them on my database, and then I'll revisit them in 3 to 6 months.
Yeah.
So I would question why, unless anybody's really motoring through the gears or motivated for some reason, you know, why buy something which is being openly marketed now at a full price with competition?
Yeah.
I think it's all about boxing clever. So find the motivated seller, find property which has been on the market for a while. If you're in the market to buy and convert property, then, you know, look at shops and offices which have been available to let for 6, 12, 18, 24 months. And then approach the landlord, see if they'll sell.
Mm-hmm.
So I would look at it from a 360 property, from a 360 position, really, rather than just a straight, okay, that property's been put on the market for sale, let's see if it stacks up and make an offer. I mean, of course, a lot of people do make a living out of that way, but I think there's probably cleverer ways of looking, of approaching deals at the moment.
Do you sometimes, just out of interest, out of your own process, do you tend to, in your own business, put in offers of where you think the deal works for you, knowing it is below the expectation of the seller, because it kind of puts a marker, depends of course if it's going to go to closing date and all that sort of stuff, that's different, but it kind of puts a marker in the sand that, you know, that should things continue to go a little bit more difficult, that actually you've got something there to go back to. You know, you were saying there about, I'll log that on my database for 3-6 months time.
Yeah.
Do you sometimes go to the bother of putting in an offer, knowing that perhaps this one might not happen, but I know that I'll be able to come back to this in 6 months' time with a much better, stronger position?
Yes, that's a good question, and I can answer this from the position of being the selling, of being, you know, a sales agent for many years. I don't, because I don't want say if something's in the market for £1 million. I'm only just talking through examples here, and I only think it's £700,000. I wouldn't make that offer. Mm-hmm. I might be missing out. I'd have a conversation with the agent to try and sound him out, but I would caution about getting known as a sort of a lowballer in your local market. You know, the agency fraternity and sorority is quite close, and if you're that person who continually lowballs, you may end up with a bit of a reputation. But and also I've seen this happen so many times when I was a selling agent, that somebody's put an offer in. You know, if I talk on the same basis, say I was selling something for £1 million, and then, you know, someone made an offer of £700,000, say over the period of 6 months, I, as a sales agent, couldn't sell it, so I had to go back and accept their offer. Lo and behold, that £700,000, which I'd been offered, is suddenly £600,000.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more frustrating as a sales agent to be on the receiving end of that.
did some of those deals still go through, out of interest?
Oh, through gritted teeth, yeah. I mean, what you've got to do as a sales agent is to remove your sort of...
Your emotion. So as a strategy from the sales, from selling property, as a strategy, it can work. But you have to remember that if you keep doing it, it may mean that you don't get shown as many deals, because they're getting cheesed off at how you're making them emotionally.
Well, that's right, and especially if you get the deal brought to you by a sourcing agent, an acquisition agent, and then you ask them to, you know, run the numbers, collect comparables, sense check the deal, and then after, you know, a month or two of due diligence, you make your offer at £700,000. your sourcing agent's going to slowly or very quickly actually stop sending you properties. My view, and others will have different views, is, you know, keep your powder dry, and at the right time then reveal your hand.
Interesting. Different approaches. Okay, great. Thanks, Andrew. I think we've covered most things. This next period is definitely going to be interesting. I guess if we get together in 18 months' time, we'll be able to see what happened, right?
What news will we have gone through by that stage? Well, we're all getting thicker skins, I guess, aren't we?
We certainly are. Yeah, it does make me laugh, some chuckle a little bit sometimes when you think of all the many things that have been thrown at us. And yeah, customers do seem to just get immune to it. Sometimes we'll get inquiries for space or take space, and I'm thinking, did you not see the news yesterday? But obviously they've just come immune to it and just getting on with it. And let's be fair, not every sector is going to be struggling. There's going to be some sectors that are going to be doing very well. And it's not like the economy suddenly stops. It's just that maybe it does a percentage or two less than what it was doing. But it can be acute for certain sectors, other sectors not so much.
Well, that's right. You know, whenever there's a fallout or a rupture in the market, that's going to present opportunities in other manners, isn't it? So, it's keeping your eye on the good news as well as the bad news.
Yeah. So
there are both.
Yeah. So going back to 2006, trying to find a property that wasn't competing with residential was really tough. You know, if you're looking at a quality building for maybe doing office space, there was another five people looking at doing it and converting it into resi, and that was a tough market. So when you were going through that period, it's really difficult because everything's fairly steady. It's all going in that direction, and it's only when the disruption came, like you said, in 2007-08, and the tail of that lasted quite long. We bought a building in 2013 that was still a casualty of the recession. It just took that long for it to sort of flush through. Mm. And that disruption, like you say, brings those opportunities, but we just have to be paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Yep. Keep educated, keep at it, and keep your fingers crossed. there's going to be some deals to come out of this, and you know, I'm afraid where there are losers, there are going to be winners. And that's the bald facts, isn't it? So just keep plugging away.
That's it. Fabulous. Okay, thanks, Andrew. Why don't you just quickly give us some details of where people can catch you if they want to talk to you directly?
Yeah, sure. So my commercial agency is tandemrealestate.co.uk. My development asset management platform is thecredo.group.
Okay.
I'm also on the advisory board at Leo Crowdfunding, the equity crowdfunding platform. And I'm doing some consultancy work at Aparo, PropTech lead generation platform at the moment. So that's aparo.co.uk.
Okay. Plenty of places to find you. And you've got an Instagram account as well.
I do, yes.
And are you on Clubhouse as much or at all?
Well, I try. I do try. You know, unfortunately, with the, you know, well, getting the kids ready for school and, you know, walking the dogs and all this, it's, you know, it's one thing that's got to go. I enjoy a good listen every now and then. There's actually some good content on there.
Yeah, there is. Okay, so Andrew, we will pop some of those in the show notes for anybody that wants to get in touch with you. Great to catch up.
Yes.
We'll pop a date in the diary for end of 23, maybe start of 24. We'll see where we're at.
See where we get to. Lovely.
Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us on the show. If any of you want to reach out, Andrew's details are going to be in the show notes. Hi there. I hope you're enjoying the content delivered on the CPI podcast. Even though it's free to listen to, it actually takes quite a bit of time and financial commitment to deliver each and every episode. Did you know that by leaving a positive written review, you will have a direct impact on the visibility of the podcast? And that's really important, because by reaching a wider audience, it helps our team to continually improve the overall content that we deliver to you week after week. For some of you, leaving a review will be second nature, but for others, it might be a first one. Open your podcast app, pick the CPI podcast, and search for previous reviews. And on iTunes in particular, click to look at all of the reviews, and then you'll see an option to leave a written review. Go on, it'll only take 2 minutes, and it'll really make our day. And we genuinely read every single one of them.